may be seated. Our next case is 14-140 Navistar versus Richard Levin. Sorry, I have to turn the page. Surprised you, didn't I?
We don't want to do that. We don't want to do that again.
Yeah. Our next case is 14-804 Hans Michael Corbin. I can't even read today. Versus Chesapeake Exploration. There is a time split, and you will be held to your time, gentlemen. We'll start with the petitioner first.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Michael S. Miller. I'm here on behalf of the petitioner, Hans Corbin, with regard to his claim that he is the owner of the mineral interest underneath his property that has been in his family since 1959, pursuant to the operation of Revised Code Section 5301.56, which is sometimes called the Dormant Mineral Rights Act. It's Mr. Corbin's position that this vesting of the mineral interest ownership thereof vested in him prior to an amendment of that statute that was effective in 2006, such that the provisions of the 2006 amended statute may not be applied to his claim. This case was filed in state court, was removed to federal court. Federal court has certified two questions of state law to this court. The first question concerns the application of the 2006 amendment of the statute. The second question concerns the effect of any delay payments made under an oil and gas lease. It is the plaintiff's position with petitioner's position with regard to the first question, whether or not the 2006 amended version of the statute can be applied to Mr. Corbin's claim, is that Ohio law is clear. Statutory amendments, even though those amendments are prospective in nature, may not reach back in time and destroy rights which had previously vested under the statute. So in our view, the issue is whether or not the statute created vested rights. It is well established in Ohio that statutes can, as well as the common law, create vested rights.
Counsel, can we focus first on just the language of the statute? Sure. That the 1989 Act said shall be deemed abandoned and vested in the owner of the surface.
Yes.
Is that language still in the Act, even in the 2006 version?
Yes.
Tell me why that's consistent. If you're saying in 1980, that the 1989 Act was self-executing, does that mean then that the 2006 Act is
no? The 2006. I'm sorry. The 2006 Act is a new law. It was enacted in 2006 by a different General Assembly, and it has different provisions and different goals and different objectives, and therefore different provisions and requirements for vesting to occur. So if this claim was brought after 2006 and there had been no vesting, we would have to comply with the 2006 version. The fact that it still says deemed abandoned, well, those words now are modified by Division E, which was added by 2006. And now it says, well, before they're deemed vested, you have to do certain things. The statute as written did not say that.
If we look at that language in the 1989 Act, the part that you say is self-executing, is there another law that you could point to where the same thing would happen, where it is self-executing and it...
I believe, Your Honor, that the statutes regarding, this court examined the statutes regarding unclaimed funds and indicated that there was no statutory provision that if a claim for those unclaimed funds hadn't been made within a certain amount of time, that those funds were abandoned. Deemed abandoned were the words I believe the court used. So our argument is that case, and I think it's the SIRS case, stands for the proposition that if a statute says deemed abandoned, that's what it means. And the respondents do seek to make much of the use of the word deemed. Well, the fact of the matter is that under the common law, you had to show that the holder actually intended subjectively to abandon. Then vesting occurred into the service owner because there was an abandonment. The statute is designed to relieve the surface owner of the burden of showing abandoned, and instead says you're deemed to have abandoned your interest if certain things have not occurred. We believe that, therefore, the language of the 88, which was effective in 89 statute, is self-executing. We believe that the courts in other states that have examined similar statutes have reached the same conclusion. We believe that every appellate court in the state that has examined that question, the 5th, 7th, and 11th, have all concluded that they are self-executing. It does not say may be deemed. It does not say shall be deemed vested if. There's no conditional language whatsoever. Shall be deemed abandoned and vested. We're just not sure in our minds how the General Assembly could have been more clear as to what its intent was in enacting this law, which is the law that we think applies to our claim.
Counsel, in your brief, and if we agree with you on that, factually, the 20 years ran, and it's abandoned.
Yes, Your Honor.
Right. But there's the second question.
Yes.
And in your brief, you outlined that you're in federal court with a whole series of stipulated facts.
Yes, Your Honor.
And I was doing pretty well, but somewhere I got lost in the weeds of all of that. Could you address the second certified question?
Certainly, Your Honor. The issue is whether or not...
Need to understand all the transactions that took place to answer that question?
No. The stipulation of facts was presented for the court if it wanted more information than was necessary. I don't think most of that information is necessary in terms of deeds being transferred. The issue is very straightforward. It's an issue of law for the most part, not a fact. Whether or not a delay payment made under an oil and gas lease is a title transaction. In the Buell case, and we're talking about oil and gas leases. In the Buell case, this court is considering the issue of whether or not the recordation of the execution of a lease or the expiration of a lease is a title transaction. The arguments in that case revolved around whether or not there was a transfer at the end of a lease. And the position of the respondents was, well, when the lease terminates, there's a transfer of that interest, it reverts back. Therefore, there's a transaction that affects title, affecting meaning changing something about the title. So now they're arguing, and we disagree with that, and we briefed it, but that's not an issue in this case. But we are arguing that, in fact, the
the issue does not relate to, that's a separate question.
Yes.
Is if the leases are getting handed over from one entity to another.
The question about whether the execution, expiration of a lease, I mean, those answers are relevant to this discussion.
All right.
But for purposes of delay payments, our point is that a delay payment does not affect title. Regardless of whether an oil and gas lease is an interest in land, which we do not believe it is. We don't believe oil and gas leases are title transactions to begin with. But with regard to delay payments in particular, they don't affect title. Nothing changes. At the termination of a lease, they say it affects title because there's a reversion. We don't think there's a reversion. We think it's a termination. But that's their argument.
Well, the purpose of it would be to maintain the interest in the minerals.
Yes.
Okay. So how does that not preserve the right?
It does. It maintains a status quo. It does not affect a change. It does not affect the title. Everything stays the same.
So you have an ownership interest in the surface, and you have a different party with an ownership interest in the minerals.
Yes.
And that's not changed by the payment? It's maintained by the payment.
Right. So nothing's changed.
And if it weren't made,
well, that's an interesting question.
Pardon me, please?
That's an interesting question because the assumption is that, if we don't make that delay payment, the lease terminates. Well, that's not true. The lease in paragraph 4 says, if we forget or omit, and they use the word omission, an omission to make that delay payment does not terminate the lease. All that happens is the lessor has to say, hey, you didn't make your payment, and then they make the payment. Now, it is true, of course, that if they don't make the payment upon demand, the lease would terminate. And under their argument, their logic, perhaps that would qualify as a transfer if there had not been a rental payment and the transfer and the rights terminated or reverted, whichever words we're going to use.
Counsel, that's an interesting question you just raised. I'm not sure it's relevant to where we are, but in your scenario, therefore, if a delay rental is not paid and the lease terminates by its terms, due demand is made, does that trigger a new 20 years? Is that a 20-year event from the time that the delay rental was not made?
We don't believe so, Your Honor. We believe that they, as we've indicated, that that is not the kind of transfer or conduct or transaction that qualifies as a title transaction, the transfer of an interest in land. We believe it's a...
Well, it's the termination of a lease, is it not,
yes,
though?
But that's not a title, in our view. I mean, that is one of the issues. Is an oil and gas lease, does it create a titled interest? Is it a license?
Those are cases that are pending with us in,
yes,
in other, or
yes,
questions, right, and cases pending in other matters. But in your situation before us, your belief is that the 1989 version is the correct version to apply here, that at some point, and when do you think that the mineral rights vested with your client?
Factually, I believe that would have been in 2004.
2004.
So it's stated in the brief, yes.
Okay. And because they pursued it in, what was it, 2013?
Yes, the lawsuit was filed in 2013.
Okay. The your position is that the vesting, the point of vesting, is the trigger as to what statute applies, not the initiation of the statute.
Yes, Your Honor.
Initiation of the lawsuit. Very simply put, that's how you're looking at
exactly,
it,
exactly,
right?
Your Honor. A vested right cannot be taken away.
And okay, how did the right become vested?
By the passage of 20 years without any statutory savings event.
Okay. And the savings event, the payment of the delayed rental was made at what year?
It was made, I think the lease was in 85, so it would have been 86, 87, 88.
And counsel, when you say, the question was, when did the interest become vested?
Yes.
And your response was 2004. But didn't your client acquire the property in 1999?
I believe that's correct.
And didn't the title specifically provide with respect to the mineral rights? It said he only acquired the surface rights, correct?
That issue then is whether or not the reservation of a mineral interest in a deed transferring the surface is a title transaction. And the statute says that the mineral interest has to be the subject of the title transaction. So merely transferring the surface rights, in our view, is not a title transaction involving the mineral interest.
I guess my point, I'm concerned more with the point that the title itself indicated who held the surface rights and who held the mineral rights, did it not? And that was in 1999.
Those have been invalidated by the statute.
By the 2006?
By the 1989.
Even though, okay, so we have the 1989 Act, but the title transaction occurs, or at least his purchase occurs in 1999.
It deprives the reservation of any legal effect, is what it does. It destroys
those. Even though he was a party to that transaction.
Yes, exactly.
Is that fair?
Yes.
Why?
Because, well, I mean, fair in whose eyes? I mean, yes, in our view.
I want your view.
In our view, this mineral interest under our land has not been properly used. And because of that, the General Assembly says it belongs to us. And we think that's fair.
Okay.
We don't think it's fair that they have sat on their rights all these years and then come back later and assert these claims. They did not file any claim to preserve this interest during the 3-year grace period afforded by the statute. And they could have done that. And they could do that indefinitely. And they still could have, even under the 2006 statute, they are allowed to do that. But they didn't do that. What they did is they abandoned it under the statute. And it's, you know, it's the General Assembly that describes, that defines what the public policy of that statute should be. And, you know, from a mineral interest holder's point of view, it may seem unfair. But that is the law. And it is important to remember, I think, that the Dormant Mineral Rights Act is intended to take away someone's property when they did not intend to abandon it. If they intended to abandon it, we'd be under the common law. We wouldn't need the DMA. The DMA is to take away something from someone that they did not intend to abandon.
Just so I understand, you said that the 20-year period ended in 04. When did it begin?
We believe it began, with the leases, it's gotten a little confused in my own mind. But we argue that even if the execution of the lease in 84 was a savings event, then they had until 89, so we had until... Oh boy, I'm going to have to apologize, Your Honor.
But the whole idea is that it began before you got the property.
Yes.
And that's yes. What is a little bit yes. confusing here, and you're tacking on that additional time.
Right, and that was the point I think in the Hefner case was that there was a chain of title as to that mineral interest, so it's not fair to take it away. But the DMA was then enacted in response to Hefner to allow that very thing to happen. It looks like my time is up. I would just briefly mention that our other position is that there was no recordation of the delay payments, and they should be recorded if they're going to give it any legal effect, just as the termination of a lease, which is statutorily required to be separately recorded.
Thank you, counsel. All right. We'll start with Ms. Bankel.
Thank you, Your Honor. Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please the court, my name is Nicole Bagnell, and I represent the lessees in this case, Chesapeake Exploration, Chesapeake Utica, Larchmont, Dale, and Total. I will be splitting my time evenly today with Mr. Ubersax, who represents the mineral owners, North American, and who plans to address the constitutionality and other impediments applying to the 2006 amendments. I would like to address the first question certified to this court and accepted by it, and that's whether does the 2006 version or the 1989 version of the ODMA apply to claims asserted after 2006, alleging the rights to oil, gas, and minerals automatically vested in the surface landowner prior to the 2006 amendments? As a preliminary issue, I think we have to first address whether or not there are actually two versions of the Act, and I believe that there are not. The Ohio Dormant Mineral Act was proposed and accepted by the General Assembly in 1989, and the operative language has not changed. In 2006, amendments were made to clarify the procedure for how it would be implemented. With that in mind, the answer to the question is that the 2006 amendments must apply to claims that are brought after 2006.
Counsel, you think that the later version of the Act was a model of clarity?
2013? I mean, I'm sorry, the 2006 amendments to the Act? Well, Your Honor, there are certainly some disputes over the 2006 amendments, but they do provide a process more clearly and more expressly than the 1989 Act originally did.
You can look at it and argue all day long whether E or I forget the numbers, which controls, because they seem somewhat logically inconsistent in that version of the Act. So when
but
you
they
say
do,
the
Your
legislature
Honor, set up, I'm sorry.
Did this to clarify, doesn't seem like that's what their goal was.
Well, I think that their intent was to clarify the procedure, and in fact they stated that in the legislative history, that the intent was to clarify what procedure you take.
Wasn't it just perhaps to say, perhaps we went too far with the first one, and before you can take away this right, you've got to give the 60-day notice.
I don't think so, Your Honor, and that really goes to my first point.
Isn't that the important difference between the two?
Well, I think that it isn't. It isn't a difference between the two. If it were, as Justice French pointed out,
where's the 60-day notice in the original Act?
Well, it's in the word deemed, Your Honor, and let me explain that. In the originally enacted Act, the legislature said that rights shall be deemed to be abandoned and vested. They didn't say abandoned and vested, they said deemed, and that had meaning. And that's why in 2006, it was clear that they were simply clarifying what that process was. If those words, those four words, were as strong as Mr. Corban argues that they are, that they automatically take away the vested rights of mineral owners, the General Assembly would have changed them in 2006 if that was their intent.
But, Council, I think your friends on the other side have, of course, a different interpretation. And when I ask, is there another act out there that has been interpreted, Mr. Miller gave me the example of the Unclaimed Funds Act that also uses the language deemed to be abandoned. How would you address that?
I would address that by saying what he didn't refer to the act so much as the case interpreting that, and that case didn't go into what the procedure was for abandonment. It was for unclaimed funds, and it was not addressing whether deemed required a procedure at all. So I just simply don't think it's applicable here.
Well, then what did the 1989 Act do? I mean, we have to make sense of it. There must be something that we have to apply rather than just saying it didn't mean anything until 2006. So what did it mean in 1989?
No, absolutely it meant something. It meant that it was a wholesale change in the law. Prior to 1989, a vested mineral owner could never lose their rights. There wasn't a way that they could be, that those rights could be taken and given to the surface owner. It was in 1989 that the legislature said, in certain cases where there lacks clarity of title, we want to make it clear, and we want to make title clear of record so that those mineral rights can be developed if we want them to be. And that's why they put in place the 1989 Act. And that's why the deemed language is so critical in that act. Why the 2006 amendments, which clarify what that means, make sense when you read it together.
Council, don't we have a retroactivity problem here? Under the 89 Act, if somebody bought a piece of property, say in 92, and they knew there were mineral rights there, and they knew full well that if they did nothing and the rest of the world did nothing for 20 years, the mineral rights were theirs, correct? Under the 89 Act, with them, no one doing a thing, not visiting the courthouse, not doing anything.
No, Your Honor.
What'd they have to do?
And Mr. Ubersachs will address retroactivity in more detail than I am, but they had to do essentially what they have to do after the 2006 amendments. They didn't automatically get the rights. The fact that it said deemed meant that another step had to be taken, be it a quiet title action, as we have here, or some other action of record. And just
they vested, right? You're going to say, when did they vest under the 89 Act?
Under the 89 Act, they vest after that next step is taken. They're deemed abandoned and vested if one of six activities which prevent forfeiture have not occurred. Someone has to make that decision that they haven't been that they have not occurred, and it's not the surface owner. As Judge DiGennaro stated in her concurring opinions in Eisenberth and other decisions from the Seventh Circuit, it indicates there's another step that must be taken, some determination of record or judicially.
But counsel, the reality is under the 89 Act, there's nothing in that statute saying they have to do anything, is there?
I believe that
it's deemed to have vested.
I believe that the word deemed means they have to do something else, and that is in line with both the legislative history and with what the General Assembly has done in other parts of the Marketable Title Act, where they've used stronger words. For example, they've used the words abandoned or null and void.
Something else probably is to clear up the title by filing a quiet title action, but you still have the issue of wasn't it vested when the time was up?
And to that, no, there has to be some determination that none of the activities which would prevent forfeiture have occurred. And so there has to be some next step of record to make it clear. I really think
you keep saying it must be a next step, but is it a fair reading to say that the interest shall be deemed abandoned and then apply deemed to modify deemed vested in the owner of the surface? And is that not at least one reading of what deemed modifies?
No, Your Honor, and I have a couple reasons for that. The first is grammatically, that isn't correct. The word and means that deemed applies to both abandoned and vested. But also, the critical word that Mr. Corban would rely on, he ignores the word deemed completely and reads it shall, abandon, and vest. Shall wouldn't apply to vest either if it doesn't, if deemed doesn't apply to vest. The only way to logically read those words together is to read that shall be deemed, abandoned and vested go together. And so I really believe that you have to look at the legislative intent and Ohio's abhorrence of forfeiture in this case to see that the purpose of the ODMA cuts against an automatic vesting argument. If the purpose is to identify or locate long unused mineral interest owners and to provide clarity of title, an act where owners who silently obtain their rights and there's nothing of record become the mineral interest owners, it simply doesn't make sense.
But counsel, I guess I don't want to be argumentative about this, but it just seems to me under the 89 Act, at the end of 20 years, if somebody hasn't done something, you're done, you're out. Whereas under the 06 Act, they say, well, why don't you post a notice and give everybody 60 days and maybe this isn't over. Isn't that a fundamental change of the property rights of the surface owner?
Well, first of all, I don't believe it's a fundamental change because if that were true, if those four words meant automatically vest in 1989, the General Assembly would have changed them if they were making a complete change in the law, and they didn't. They left those words in. All they did was provide a procedure. And in fact, the mineral rights are vested in the mineral owner, unless none of the activities that are provided
counsel,
for in the
you're
ODMA.
Way into your co-counsel's presentation.
Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court. As my co-counsel indicated, I am going to address whether there's any constitutional or retroactivity prohibition on applying the 2006 amendments here. First of all, to be clear, we are not seeking to apply the law retroactively. The petitioner had no claim when these amendments went into effect in 2006. His claim was not filed until 7 years later in 2013.
He wasn't vested in 2006, you're saying?
Well, of course, no. We say he didn't vest under the old statute, and he doesn't vest under the new statute.
But when you say he had no claim, you're really saying he didn't present a claim in court.
He did not present any claim.
Okay.
He did not present a claim. And
but do you agree, what date would you say that he was eligible to present a claim in court?
Well, our point is that there was no savings event, but there were savings events, and he had never had a claim under the original act. But under their argument, they could have had a claim as early as 1992. 3 years after the 1989 Act went into effect. And of course, they claim that at that point they automatically became vested. We have shown in our briefs that there is no fair interpretation of the original Act allows for automatic vesting, given the purposes of the Act, which are to clarify the chain of title and to allow persons to rely on the chain of title. If you
well,
have
if you're
automatic.
About, counsel, if you're talking about chain of title this was titled in 1999 in his name. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. And that title transaction referenced the reservation of the mineral rights, correct?
Correct. Well, it referenced all previous reservations. Didn't specifically call out the mineral reservation, but it did. It was made subject to
transactions involving mineral rights. There was a reservation, or at least in that document, you would say, if I'm a stranger to the history of this piece of property, and I look at that transfer in 1999, and that's the last time there was a recorded deed, correct? I would look at it and say, wait a second, there might be some mineral rights that don't go along with the surface rights. Wouldn't that tell me that?
That would tell you that, yes, there had been a previous
assignment,
reservation,
or
and separation
of mineral
the two rights,
a lease of mineral rights, ownership of mineral rights in someone other than the surface owner.
Correct.
And isn't that what these two statutory provisions attempt to do?
Exactly right. The statute addresses the situation, and it applies wherever the owner of record of the minerals is different from the owner
of
record of the surface.
When there's been a severing of the mineral rights from the surface rights, there has to be some acknowledgement of that, so that, or record of that, so that strangers to those transactions will have notice. And that's what this is all about.
That's what this is all about.
Right. And if we determine, because we have other cases that are pending here, but should we address that and say that the 1999 deed transfer that mentions the mineral rights is a savings transaction? Where are you?
Well, if that is a savings event, then of course you add 20 years past 1999, and then you get well within the 2006 Act. You then apply all the requirements of the 2006 Act. That is, our position. And
but your position is not because of the 1999 deed transfer, is it?
No, it's because the 2006 Act was in force when this claim was first made.
You're saying that's the statute at the time that the legal action was initiated, and therefore that's the statute that governs. You're
right.
Not looking at what opposing counsel would say, that the vesting date was 89 or whenever it was, and then it tacks on to the current owners, and their position is a little bit different. But if we decide that a savings transaction has occurred, which or savings event has occurred with a deed transfer, you're in the same place, right?
You're in the same place the 2006 Act would apply.
Counsel, if I may, I want to try one more time, though, on this mm-hmm. one question. You will agree that as to a lease that has gone past 20 years with no saving event, that the mineral holders received a brand new gift in the 06 Act that breathed life into a dead lease, did it not?
I would not agree with that, unless that.
Well, it was dead.
The surface owner.
Let's say it was dead in 05. Let's say the lease was dead in 05.
Well, he gets what the Dahlgren case, for example, referred to as an inchoate right. I mean, the statute says that he shall. That the interest under those circumstances shall be deemed abandoned and vested, but that implicitly requires that there is some judicial act or some determination that places on the record this transfer of the interest. Because again, that you have to look at it in terms of the whole purpose of the Marketable Title Act, of which the Dormant Mineral Act is a part.
I'm just trying to figure out your position, because I don't understand how the 06 Act does not give new rights to mineral holders.
Well, all it does, Your Honor, is to change the procedures for asserting rights.
No, they didn't used to have 60 days.
Well, these are matters of procedure. When you look at the substantive core of the statute, which defines when and under what circumstances mineral rights are abandoned or to be deemed abandoned, that core was unchanged. There is the substantive core of the statute was left untouched, and instead all the legislature did was implement new procedures. Now, it is true that following those new procedures can in some circumstances lead to different results from the old statute, but it isn't necessarily the case that that will happen. And that's why there's no constitutional problem here. It's not a situation where the legislature, by taking away, for example, a common law right of action, or changing the substantive elements of a right of action, as in the Van Fossen case, wipes out a substantive claim that existed. Here, all that's happening is that a new procedure's been set up. And if the petitioner or people in his position are not able to make a successful claim under the new act, that's because of their inability or refusal or failure to follow these new procedures. It's not because the legislature, by its own fiat, just wiped out a set of substantive rights. And it's very similar to this court's own Longbottom case, where the court looked at new notice procedures set up with regard to prejudgment interest.
But will you not agree, sir, that if you have a farmer who owns a farm, and grandpa put a lease into it back in the 30s, and the farmer in 2005 is saying, well, I'm thinking of selling, and I own the mineral rights because those are abandoned. Nobody's done anything for 50 years. And then the legislature says, oh, by the way, in 06, they said, oh, by the way, let's give anybody from the 30s another 60 days to see if they really want to have this lease. Isn't that a new right in that property, in those mineral holder heirs?
It is not a new right, Your Honor. It's not a new substantive right. It's a new procedural right. And both sides are given new procedural rights. And it's the exercise of those rights or the failure to exercise those rights.
So on day one, they have a piece of paper that's worth zero. And on day two, they have a piece of paper that's worth $1 million. That's not substantive.
Well, the outcome of the claim, again, is decided by the procedure, not by a simple legislative act. And that's the point. I mean, if the legislature had done something which automatically and by itself wiped out something worth several million dollars, that would be an issue. And that's what you see in the previous cases on retroactivity. But here, that didn't happen. Again, we're just setting up new procedures, and they may change the result, they may not. I mean, in your example, there's a 60-day period, but the mineral owner of record might not exercise that right at all. Even today, someone who claims to have automatically been vested under the original act, they can still file claims under the new act, and the result might be exactly the same as under the old act. And that's particularly...
Counsel, thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel. You've used your time. You may take a minute.
Thank you very much. With regard to the reservation of a mineral interest and a deed transferring the surface, I think the point is the General Assembly said that's not anything that the holder of the mineral interest has done or is involved in. It's just a sale of the surface from one person to another. It is not a use of the mineral interest.
What would be the, you go back to the basic premise of why do we need documents to be recorded. It's not for the benefit necessarily of the people who are transferring the piece of property. Here it was done within the family. It's for the benefit of the public, for the neighbors, for the community. It's notice. That's what this is all primarily.
That's what recording is about, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. But with regard to then when this claim vested, which the question was asked and I had some confusion with, we believe that if a lease is not a savings event, this interest vested in Mr. Corbin's predecessor's entitle at the end of the grace period in 1992. If the lease is effective, but not the termination, we believe that it vested in 2004. With regard to the unclaimed fund case, I did not mean to state that the statute says deemed abandoned. I think what I tried to say is the court said these funds were not abandoned because the statute did not say they would be deemed abandoned. On the other hand, in this case, it does say deemed abandoned. And deemed, we have addressed and we have discussed, and we believe that it says treated as if.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement and you'll be notified of our decision.